less than a month after a debate performance that shook Democrats' faith in his ability to win re-election, President Joe Biden dropped out of the presidential race and threw his support behind Vice President Kamala Harris. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on the Weekly News Review, we're going to talk about how DNC delegates in Ohio and Kentucky are reacting to this change at the top of the party's ticket and what the shift could mean for the trajectory of Ohio's U.S. Senate race. We'll also discuss an ongoing dog fight over a proposed Cincinnati dog park, and we'll hear the latest on Hebrew Union College and the legal dispute surrounding its collection of rare books. Joining me now to get us started are Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you, Lucy.
Always great to have you. And Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thanks for being here, Sylvia. 2 weeks in a row, we appreciate that.
Glad to be here, as always.
Well, Joe, let's start by talking about Senator Sherrod Brown. He's one of the few Democrats holding statewide office in Ohio. He faces a tough race to keep his seat. What does President Biden's decision to drop out of the race mean for him?
Well, if you talk to some of the political scientists that I've talked to, they say that this could be a very good change for him because, you know, Biden was his polling was lackluster, let's just put it that way. And there was a question as to whether he could actually win. And the strength always comes from the top of the ticket in an election year when it involves a presidential election. So your presidential election candidates are the ones that, you know, people go to vote on president and then they vote down the ticket. So if you've got more people coming out to vote, which that's what politicians, people who follow this say might happen. You got more Democrats to come out. That helps Sherrod Brown. Hmm.
Do these political scientists you interview, do they think a Harris campaign has any chance of winning Ohio?
Yes, they do. They think she can generate some excitement, that she can bring in people who have been sitting on the sidelines and haven't been voting. There are pockets in Ohio where Democrats are registered, but they don't vote anymore. These were the people who voted, you know, maybe during President Obama's time in office, that kind of thing. But they're not voting anymore. There's the thought that this might encourage them to vote. And we saw just this morning that former President Obama and his wife Michelle came out and they have endorsed Kamala Harris as the president. And that is a big deal because if it can bring in those Obama voters who have been sitting on the sidelines and haven't been voting, that could, every little bit helps.
Well, and we're all assuming that Vice President Harris is going to be the nominee. I know she's gotten lots of support, but there's going to be, it'll become official near or at the Democratic National Convention. It's going to be a very different kind of convention, isn't it? Talk to us about that, Joe.
Yeah, actually, I think it's going to be official when they make this. They're planning to do some sort of Zoom call, the DNC is, to accommodate early deadlines, like Ohio's deadline is the 7th of August to get on the ballot in November. Now, Ohio, the lawmakers passed a thing that, you know, could allow them to go later, but I think they're still, the last I've heard, they're still going with this plan of doing something early to accommodate that. And when they do that, that will pretty much make it official. But of course, the celebration will be at the DNC when they hold their convention. And, you know, this is the first time in a long time when they haven't gone in there with everything just planned and in order. So there's a little element of uncertainty, although every Democrat at the State House that I know of, and certainly nationally, with the exception of maybe Joe Manchin and a couple of others, everyone seems to be rallying behind Kamala Harris. So if that's the case, you know, it's just going to be fun to watch to see how it plays out, honestly.
Yeah. Sylvia, Kentucky's Democratic delegates have voiced strong support for Vice President Harris. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so almost immediately on Monday morning, the delegates met for an informal vote to see where they all stood. Governor Andy Beshear made the motion that they vote to endorse Kamala Harris, and almost unanimously they did. I say almost because there was one person who held out who said that she wasn't ready yet to endorse Harris. That was a uncommitted delegate. So, you know, that's also something to watch nationally, too. You know, there are a few uncommitted delegates who are going to be coming to this convention. So see if they line up behind Harris in the same way that Democrats largely are. But yeah, they voiced very strong support, just in the same way that Governor Andy Beshear has as well.
And was that vote binding?
It was not. So no binding votes, I don't think, are happening anywhere really yet. So it was an informal vote just to see basically where everyone stands and to, you know, be able to basically put out a statement that the Kentucky Democratic Party delegates are standing behind Kamala Harris.
You mentioned Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. I think he's the Kentucky delegate everyone's been watching the most closely. What has he said about Vice President Harris's candidacy?
Well, he stood very strongly behind her, and you know, he's been making a couple of national news appearances to really highlight that point. He calls her, you know, smart, strong. He's really kind of going behind her in pumping up the fact that she's a former attorney general, just like Andy Beshear was a former attorney general. And you know, he's also been making some pretty He's leaning into an attack dog kind of persona here, also going after, you know, former President Donald Trump and also running mate J.D. Vance. He's made a lot of comments against Vance and, you know, his various, you know, whether he stands behind Trump in the past and his persona in Appalachia. But yeah, he's definitely been standing very firmly behind Harris.
There's been a lot of talk about Governor Beshear as a possible vice presidential running mate with Vice President Harris, with her at the top of the ticket. What's the latest on that? What have you been hearing?
Yeah, so, I mean, like I just said, he's already kind of adopting a little bit of that attack dog persona that you might expect from a vice presidential candidate. And yeah, his name is definitely being thrown around. You know, I'm not sure where he stands in this lineup. It's every day you hear different reports about, you know, who the Harris campaign is considering for the position. Like Joe was just saying, I think that there's been at least some reports that they're planning on coming out with that candidate before August 7th, that they want to get that locked down a little bit early before the convention. But, you know, there's a long list of names, and Beshear has generally been considered on that list. You know, he's a Democratic governor in a red state. I think it's a little bit of a long shot to say that he could flip Kentucky blue, but, you know, he does have, you know, he's been kind of pointed out that he can maybe talk to rural voters more than Harris could. He's popular in his state, despite Kentucky being quite red. You know, all those things are potentials that they're looking at for a vice presidential candidate.
Does Governor Beshear seem open to the idea?
Well, he won't come out and say that, right? But he does. He definitely is. Says that he's, you know, flattered to be considered. He seems to, you know, be talking about being involved in the process, although he won't say expressly the situation. Yesterday at a news conference, he implied that he may be being vetted, but he, you know, didn't say that explicitly. But, you know, just kind of reiterating that he wouldn't take any other job, that he loves being governor, but he would only consider another job if he thought he could help Kentuckians in a new, special way. That's kind of how he's been framing it.
Joe, what's been the reaction from Ohio's delegation for the Democratic National Convention?
Well, they're much like the Kentucky delegation. They came out, they've endorsed, you know, kind of informally endorsed, at least, you know, Vice President Harris. They say they're behind her. Now, you know, it's not binding, you know, they're all kind of free agents, if you will, and they could go to the convention floor and they could, you know, endorse someone else. But right now they're all behind Kamala Harris.
What are some of them saying about why they're backing Vice President Harris?
They think that she has the skills, they say, to get it done. They've been talking about her background as a someone who's got a judicial background, and you juxtapose that with former President Trump, who has been in a little bit of trouble with the law lately. You've got, you know, that part of it. You've got the fact that she's more exciting and they think she can bring in younger voters and voters who have felt like they haven't had a voice recently, that they like that fact. They like the fact that she's just kind of a person who's got a really solid resume, yet she's young, vibrant, and comes with new perspective. And you know, this morning I was looking at her ad that was put out, and it features a song by Beyonce. It's Freedom. And I was looking at that ad and I was thinking, ooh, that looks a lot like the Obama-esque kind of thing that I saw when he was running for office. So I think that, you know, she kind of brings that element of something that hasn't been there for a while in the Democratic Party. And that's what the delegates see.
Yeah. Sylvia, I want to get back to Kentucky for a moment. If Governor Beshear does get picked to be the Democratic vice presidential nominee, and we know that's not a done deal, there's still a lot of people who are being discussed for that, what would happen? Would he have to resign his job as governor?
So he would not have to resign. He could still run on the national ticket, campaign, do whatever he needs to do for that and stay governor. You know, there are actually some states, like, for example, North Carolina, that have some kind of funky rules about like if the governor is out of state, the lieutenant governor becomes acting. That's not the case in Kentucky. But this is so many layers of if, too. It's so many layers of speculation. But if Beshear were to get on the ticket and then they were to win, the person who would take over after him would be the lieutenant governor, and she would serve until the end of that term, which is in 2027. So it's actually, he has a significant amount of time left on his term here, too, which I think is something to take into account.
What has Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman said about whether she's ready for the job if all those ifs come to pass?
Well, essentially, she said that, yeah, she would be ready to take on the job, that, you know, she feels like Beshear wouldn't have chosen her if he didn't think she was ready. You know, Coleman has been really strong. Her name, Jacqueline Coleman, has been really strong on education. And she, you know, she's a former coach, former school administrator. So she has a background in this. In education, which is obviously always going to be a huge topic in state government. And so she's expressed for sure that she thinks that she would be ready to take on the job. But again, a lot of ifs, not likely that would happen anytime soon.
Right. I'm going to ask you a very awkward question to ask a reporter, Sylvia, but do you have any sense of what the odds are that Governor Beshear could be selected? I mean, as you mentioned, a new poll found he's pretty darn popular, isn't he?
Oh, the odds. You're right. That is a hard question to ask a reporter, you know, but I'm loath to weigh in necessarily. I think there are a lot of really strong people, actually, that are being considered right now that, you know, there may be in swing states, for example, like Senator Mark Kelly in Arizona or Roy Cooper in North Carolina, governor. You know, those are both people in swing states. Kentucky, like I said, is not a swing state. So I think that definitely might work against him a little bit when we're thinking of odds. But, you know, and we're going to find out pretty soon, too. So I wouldn't want to weigh in necessarily. But I do think that he's definitely a name to watch out for. And even if this vice presidential campaign doesn't pan out, I think that his name cropping up here is a sign that he's trying to raise his national profile in general, that a lot of, you know, donors and politicos on the national level are watching him. And so I don't think this is, even if Kamala Harris decides to go in a different direction, I don't think this is the last time we'll be hearing Beshear's name in a national context.
Well, because I believe you reported on a new poll that found he's the most popular Democratic governor in the country right now, isn't he? At least according to that
yes.
poll?
Yes. And now it's worth noting that's among Kentuckians, right? So Kentuckians or people in their state are voting on the job approval rating. But yeah, he has the highest approval rating of any Democratic governor. There's only one governor who beat him out nationally, and that was a Republican in Vermont. But no, he is really popular within the state. And notably, he's the most popular Democratic governor among Republicans, too, which is an interesting statistic to think about. And, you know, he's also, you know, somehow he's managed to toe that line, also the most popular among Democrats. So within his state.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, that's definitely numbers that I would imagine the Harris campaign is looking at and checking in on, you know, but right, this is a national campaign. The question is, would that appeal carry over to other states, to people outside of Kentucky?
How long has it been since a Kentuckian's been on a major presidential ticket? It's been quite a while, hasn't it?
A very long time. The last time was President Truman's vice president, when he ran for election. So it's definitely been a minute. And I think it would be interesting to have a Kentuckian on the ticket. I know that it's definitely raising excitement among Kentucky voters and among Kentucky Democrats to even have the potential of someone from their state. A lot of Democrats in the state feel like they've kind of been written off, like, you know, the national party doesn't pay attention to them as much. So I think this is really exciting for a lot of Democrats in the state.
Joe, before we let y'all go, I want to talk about another important statewide issue that's going to be on the Ohio ballot in November. That's this effort to reform the state's redistricting process. Tell us about Citizens Not Politicians. What's that all about?
Well, Citizens Not Politicians, one of the leaders of it is former Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, a Republican who was at the top of the Supreme Court. And she was the swing vote in seven different times that the Supreme Court shot down the redistricting maps that we've been using. They seven different times they said those were unconstitutional. Maureen O'Connor was at the helm. So she's helped write this initiative. And basically what it does is it takes politicians out of the process and it replaces it with a citizen panel. Now, we know some other states have it, like Michigan has a citizen panel. There's other states that have it. But it's the idea is that politicians cannot be trusted when it involves their own livelihood, their own power, and that they need to be cut out. They've been working on it. They submitted the petition signatures, and those petition signatures were just certified Monday. So we know it's going to be on the ballot in November.
How many signatures did they need? How many did it gather?
Well, they needed about 414,000 valid signatures. They submitted over 700,000 valid signatures, or 700,000 signatures, but over 500,000 of them were valid. So they had about 100,000 more than what they actually needed. But they even had more than that. They just weren't certified.
And I understand elected Republicans are expected to oppose this measure. Why is that?
Well, they're in power. The Republicans that are in power here in Ohio have they like it. They like having the power, number one. They're also the ones who came up with the maps that we're using. They feel like the process is fair, and they don't want to change it. They don't want to take the power away from politicians, especially when they're the ones with it. What we're kind of looking here for is to see what kind of alternative is offered by these Republicans, because they're not going to want to sit on their hands while this is happening. I mean, politicians in general, if you go out on the street and talk to people, they kind of groan when you mention politicians. They're pretty low on the, you know, public totem pole, if you will. But, you know, this is they want to make it so that, people know that their elected officials are going to be taken out of the process.
Well, I want to mention we're going to have former Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor on Cincinnati Edition next Thursday, August 1st. She'll be talking about this proposal, so we'll get into a lot more detail with her. What's the next step for this whole thing, Joe?
Well, the next step is to go to the Ohio Ballot Board, and that will be happening pretty soon because they only have, a couple weeks that they can schedule and do it. Now, the Ohio Ballot Board is once again controlled by Republicans. And if you remember last year when the abortion amendment was put on the ballot, the language that was adopted as a ballot summary, now that's the thing you see at the top of the ballot, that language was vastly different than the language that was in the summary of the amendment itself. And so the thing to watch here is, what will the ballot board do with the language? Will they muddy it? Will they make it confusing? How significantly will it be changed? And there's a lot, you know, a lot riding on how that process plays out.
How difficult do you think it'll be to explain this issue to voters? I mean, it's pretty complicated. Redistricting in general is pretty complicated. Do you think it's going to be tough to explain to voters what this is and why it's important?
It always has been. If you look in the past at the different times that redistricting was on the ballot, it was a very difficult thing to explain to voters. And when it did pass, it was passing with Republican support. So it didn't have a lot of confusing information out there. Redistricting is not an easy thing to understand on the surface, and you have to take a moment to actually figure out what it is, how it works, and that sort of thing. And the question is, will voters who are more concerned in voting in a presidential race or a Senate race, will they take the time to actually figure out what redistricting is and how this works and how they feel about it?
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Up next, we'll hear why a proposed dog park in Cincinnati continues to draw howls of opposition. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A proposed dog park in Burnet Woods has been a source of contentious conversation at Cincinnati Parks Board meetings for years, and the battle is continuing. Joining me now to explain the origins of this dog park dog fight, say that three times fast, is Cincinnati Enquirer, Enterprise, and Watchdog reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry. Welcome back, Patty.
Hi, Lucy.
Hey. And it did occur to me that it's really appropriate that a Watchdog reporter is covering this dog park issue. So
let's get all the jokes.
That's
in
right.
As
all the puns.
Possible.
Yes, all the puns. Because this is a very serious issue for folks in those neighborhoods. What's the history with this proposed dog park in Burnet Woods?
My notes remind me this actually dates back to 2014 when a UC class proposed the idea of a dog park. But in the last 4 years, the park board has really been moving forward with the idea of a Clifton dog park. At first, there were seven sites considered. The very first pick was Denore Park, just a little almost pocket park in Clifton. That neighborhood or that segment of Clifton voted it down. And so the park board returned to the drawing table and picked this Burnet Woods site.
This has become very controversial in the neighborhood. Why are opponents so strongly opposed to this?
They have a long list, starting with loss of green space. Even though it's a very large park at 90 acres, there aren't a lot of just clear, open green spaces where people can maybe do a picnic or play with their kids. The idea of putting down artificial turf is probably the biggest flashpoint. Folks are opposed to that, saying even the kind that's billed as non-toxic does have a detrimental effect to the environment, to the groundwater, has to be replaced, and so on and so forth. So those are two of the big concerns, but also just the noise of dogs, the potential danger when big and little dogs are together and there's no way to separate them in this very small proposed park. Traffic, you know, kind of the usual litany of concerns.
Yeah. Why do supporters of the dog park want it there?
Mostly these are dog owners who live in Clifton. There isn't another convenient place to take your dogs that's nearby. One of the leading proponents, Cassandra Clement, has a son with disabilities, and he really enjoys dog parks because they're open to all, accessible. He likes dogs. It's a non-judgmental social place for him to be. But they have quite a contingent over in Clifton proper for these things they call the puppy party is the name of their group, where they get together on a regular basis. And that's a very, very small spot that they'd like a real established dog park to take the place of.
Yeah. We did get an email from a listener earlier today. Susan writes, this kind of pushback is what happens when a wealthier neighborhood like Clifton Gaslight is afforded community engagement regarding a dog park near their homes, while the neighborhood of Coryville was not even informed of the decision the park board made on July 15, 2021. Coryville has a 52.9% poverty rate and only 1.6% tree canopy cover, which is ranked 45th of all communities assessed. Coryville has some of the highest percentage of residents that rent, 92%, spend more than 30% of their income on rent. Coryville residents also have among the highest energy costs for all communities assessed. Burnett Woods is the lungs for Coryville, Clifton Heights, University Heights, Fairview, and Mount Auburn. This is environmental injustice. And the email goes on, but it's that's the gist of it. Are you hearing those kinds of arguments about kind of the disparity in wealth and power and that sort of thing in these discussions?
A little bit. There are sometimes allegations that Clifton gets more than its fair share for a variety of reasons, education level being one, activism being one. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How much time has this discussion consumed for the Cincinnati Parks Board?
It comes up almost every meeting. The last board meeting, it took 40 minutes out of a 2.5 hour meeting. So that was a fair chunk. And that's why I wrote about it this week, because it comes up time and time again. This is a park system with 5,000 acres, takes up 10% of Cincinnati land, has, you know, dozens and dozens of facilities and priorities. And yet this is on almost every agenda and fills the minutes of each board meeting where folks are writing into park board members.
Hmm. And this, you mentioned that Burnett Woods is a pretty big park. How big is the current plan for this dog park? Is it a fairly small piece of land when looking at the entire park?
It definitely is. It's 8,800 square feet, which is about a fifth of an acre. Compare that, for example, to the dog park in Mount Airy Forest, which is the Doris Day Dog Park. That's almost 4 acres. So it's a postage stamp compared to other facilities.
Yeah. Did this battle over this dog park, has it had an impact over the makeup of the park board itself?
Some people would say yes. Jim Getz was serving as the president of the park board for the last, I don't know total number of years, but when his term was ending, his 6-year term was ending, he was not appointed to another term by the mayor. And instead, the mayor appointed John Nyer to step into the role. And according to emails that we received from the city with a public records request, he was opposed in that role for a variety of reasons, but among them was the dog park.
Mm. So people had complained to the mayor, hey, you need to get rid of this person because of the dog park.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened.
Yeah. You mentioned that this project was discussed at a park board meeting earlier this week. Where does the project stand?
It's a little bit muddled, as the park itself may become muddled. The park board approved the latest plan, which is to reduce the use of artificial turf, put in some sod, and make some other changes, largely because of finances. The bid came in considerably higher than anticipated. And so the park board has sent administration back to the drawing board, want them to figure out an alternative to artificial turf, as well as secure the last $81,000 that is needed to move it forward. And so, you know, the next couple of meetings, I think we'll have some clarity on the timing. Parks Director Jason Barron did tell the board that it would take 1 to 2 months to redesign and 1 to 2 months to take care of other necessary, you know, protocols, and that all those things, if they stick, the park should be open this winter.
Oh, wow. We just got a call from Cynthia. She didn't stay on the line, but she says the new plans for the dog park have made changes that mean the park would no longer be ADA accessible, and that was a cost-cutting measure. Was there discussion of that at the meeting?
There are some aspects that make it less accessible. A curb cut was eliminated from the plan. Some handicap parking spaces was eliminated from the plan. The loss of artificial turf, if that comes to pass, could have a detrimental effect on accessibility if it's replaced with some kind of material that is not as easy to navigate. you know, gravel, for instance, or any kind of aggregate rock product could be difficult for wheelchairs, strollers, people with walkers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's unknown what the administration is going to come back with as an alternative to the artificial turf.
And you mentioned this concern over artificial turf and how much smaller this dog park is than the dog park in Doris Day, Mount Airy.
Yeah.
Has this shrunk in size or scale over the years? Did it start out as a bigger dog park plan?
Only modestly. So I think the very first plan, and we're on the third iteration, the first one was around 10,000 square feet, and now it's 88. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So a little bit smaller, but not substantially.
But one of the aspects to consider with the artificial turf is that if you remove all that and you replace it with sod, you're going to have a very small park that's going to be torn up more quickly with nowhere else to rotate. And so during wet seasons, you know, if that grass goes bad, they're going to have to close it or limit access to it while they reseed and regrow. So this is a real challenge for the board, for the parks to figure out how to handle this.
And is that something they do in the much bigger park that's, you said, like 4 acres or something? Are they able to kind of rotate like that?
They are. Yeah, they are. And some of our dog parks in Cincinnati that are not under the parks control have different sections for big dogs and little dogs, right? And they can open up one section, close another section. And as I said, they can rotate, you know, much like you rotate crops. You can take something offline while it regenerates and repairs and then bring it back on.
Yeah, give it a break. The group that is opposed to this is called Preserve Burnett Woods. Has that group voiced concerns about the avian population in the park? Is that part of their environmental argument?
That has been. Owls in particular have been mentioned as being threatened by dog noise primarily. Mm. I would point out, though, that Preserve Burnett Woods is one of about 7 different groups that have tallied their opposition. A lot of the community councils in the neighborhood have come out with official no votes on this.
Yeah. You mentioned that there was one park board member who was replaced, and it's not 100% clear that that was related to the dog park, but it sure looks like it based on these emails you got through an open records request. What are the current park board members saying about this? Can you tell how much support there is for this project? If they're more skeptical, what are they saying?
I would say the addition of John Nyer to the board has added a more, I wouldn't say a full pause, but some caution. This last meeting of last week was the first time that I heard a park board commissioner say out loud in a public meeting, express any reservations. So Mr. Nyer got the ball rolling. He initially said his vote was going to be no, based on the latest design. And then after, you know, this 40 minutes of discussion, they came to a resolution to the things I mentioned. Look at an alternative to the turf. And secure the remaining funds. And after that, he was ready to support that. But Nyer is the first one who opened the way for people to offer any skepticism. And then Phyllis McCallum also said she had reservations. She felt like she was not hearing from enough supporters as opposed to opponents. Kick Lee, also a newer park commissioner, said that he supports it, but wants to make sure that people who do support it will come out and be active and take care of the park, use it, pick up after their dogs, pick up the trash, et cetera. Yeah. So
it's been a long time since I've been to a park board meeting. How many board members are there?
There are 5.
Okay.
They're appointed by the mayor for 6-year terms.
Okay. Okay. So if you've got 3 that have concerns, that's a big signal.
It is.
Yeah. What do you think has made this project so controversial for so long?
The tenacity of Clifton advocates, I would say. Some really smart folks have some really serious concerns that they articulate again and again. And they, you know, I use tenacious in the most measured of ways. I don't mean that to be a knock. I mean, they just stay with it, right? A lot of times you have community members who come and go, but they have just not given up. Every meeting every year, 4 years in a row, there's some presence.
Wow, that is perseverance for sure. What's next with this whole project?
Well, in 1 to 2 months, the director of parks will come back to the board and provide an updated plan on whether what kind of material could replace the artificial turf and whether they're successful in getting the last $81,000. And after that, I assume we'll have another vote. So that could be the August meeting or the September meeting. And we will see after that if there's any more give on the board and pivot yet again.
We did get a call from Louise. Louise says the dog park is opposed by the Audubon Society and the park is an important location as designated by the Audubon Society. Has that come up also?
It has. And that's Louise Nippert, who I've spoken to before. So as I said, they stay on it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Patty, thank you so much. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer, Enterprise, and Watchdog reporter Patricia Gallagher-Newberry. We really appreciate your time today, Patty.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll discuss the latest on Hebrew Union College and its collection of rare books. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A legal dispute has been swirling for months over the fate of a collection of rare books at the Cincinnati campus of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk joins me now to explain the latest developments and what's at stake. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. Dan, give us some perspective on the Clow Library on the campus of Hebrew Union College. What kind of books does it hold, and why are they so rare?
Well, they're rare because they date back many hundreds of years. This library was established in 1875, and its collection includes some 14,000 rare books, including the world's largest collection of Chinese manuscripts that identify Jewish families dating back to the Ming Dynasty. And they also, the kind of a darling of their collection is a polyglot or multilingual version of the Book of Psalms that was created in 1516. So there's a lot of history in those walls.
Sure, sounds like it. You first reported about this in May. What happened that raised concerns about the future of these books?
I think the concerns really date back to January when the director of libraries left a resignation letter citing pressure to sell rare books. And this followed a downsizing of the Cincinnati campus by the New York-based leadership of HUCJIR, short for Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. And so The campus ended its rabbinical training on campus there I guess it was about 2 years ago now. And then they downsized their graduate programs as well. And that led a lot of people on campus to question the long-term survivability of this campus, and including this Clow Library. Now, at the time when they closed the rabbinical program, the college leadership promised that Cincinnati would remain an important research center and that the Clow and other assets would be used to attract scholars from all over the world and all over, the HUC system. So when it became clear that they were looking at possibly selling some of these assets, that kind of raised the alarm bell on the Cincinnati campus.
When I know Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost got involved, what was he seeking through the courts?
Well, Ohio regulates charities, and when they sought a court order, they made an argument that the school has failed to live up to its fiduciary responsibility under Ohio laws governing charitable trusts, claiming that they were secretly taking steps to sell or deaccession, not make them part of their collection, these rare collection items. The school has denied that, since for as long as I've been talking to them about it. In May, they said that they don't plan to sell these assets. They were trying to measure their value as part of kind of their stewardship responsibilities of knowing what they have in their collection. But they also said as early as May that they can't rule out the sale of items in the future. So I think Yost's office was trying to trying to determine A, whether the assets are going to be sold, and B, whether they violate any donor restrictions or any fiduciary responsibilities that HUC has.
So that's the background of this very complicated situation. What happened earlier this month with this case?
Well, there was an agreed order. The parties agreed that no books, no rare books, would be sold for at least 6 months. And that means the case will continue, whether it continues toward a negotiated settlement or whether the matter gets litigated is not clear yet. But at least for the next 6 months, the parties have agreed that none of these rare books will be sold or be removed from Ohio. And so that kind of maintains the status quo for the next several months.
We know Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is very engaged with this. Is there a lot of public sentiment? Have you heard from a lot of people who care deeply about these books and don't want to see them sold?
We've heard from people around the country. Most of the folks who are affiliated with the school and have fond recollections of their time in Cincinnati. There is a group of former board members of HUC who are trying to start up a rabbinical program in Cincinnati to kind of restore that kind of education that has happened there for more than a century. And it's really not clear whether they would try to occupy HUC or make use of its library and research assets. But I mean, that is something that they would like to achieve if they're able to start this new school.
And
in Cincinnati, yeah.
Yeah. I want to come back to what Hebrew Union College has been telling you about all this. Are they saying they haven't never intended to sell the books? Are they not breaching their fiduciary duties? Or are those the same thing? I mean, if they wanted to sell the books, do they say that wouldn't breach their fiduciary duties? How clear is all that?
Yeah, it's not terribly clear. They have said publicly, their president has said that it might be that they find that they have duplicate assets. You know, you don't need two versions of the same book, I guess. And it's possible that, you know, they might sell one to preserve the rest of the collection. And they're not really clear on what they would sell, what they wouldn't sell. What they've said in their most recent court filing is that HUC is not now, nor has it ever been, in breach of its fiduciary obligations. And it remains committed to operating the Clow Library and managing its collection consistent with its fiduciary obligations. So they're just flatly denying that they will violate any of Ohio's laws in this regard, and that, you know, that they maintain the, I think what they're trying to do is maintain the ability to operate this collection in a way that's feasible for them and protects the historic obligations that they have to donors who help them get this property.
And it sounds like, based on what you said, this latest order does not resolve this dispute, right?
No, it doesn't. There's an August 12th case management conference. There's no trial date that's been set. But, you know, it is possible that Dave Yost's office will, you know, try to dig deeper into some of these questions we're addressing right now, like what do you want? What would you sell if you ever sold? Which of these assets are protected by donor restrictions? It could be that they want to inventory everything that, you know, that HUC has, just to make sure that that none of these charitable laws are violated by a sale.
What's the overall picture for Hebrew Union College? I know they issued a statement saying, quote, "This is a complicated time for both higher education and the Jewish world, and HUCJIR will be faced with difficult choices as we shape the future of our institution and the road ahead," end quote. What kind of financial picture are they in? I know a lot of small colleges and universities have really been struggling in recent years.
Yeah, they've been facing declining enrollment, declining revenue for years. That's one reason why they closed the rabbinical school, the residency program at Cincinnati. And it's I haven't really dug into their financials. I've seen reporting that indicates that they have rising deficits, and that's one motivating factor for them wanting to sell some of these assets to cover some of their losses. They've denied that, and I haven't had the time to really dig into their finances to determine what kind of shape they're in.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned this alternate rabbinical school. How are those plans going? Have they made a lot of progress? What do you know about how that's shaping up?
Well, I talked to a local attorney who's one of the organizers of this effort. They have formed a nonprofit, and they've raised, I think it's less than $100,000 to sort of explore this. They haven't reached the point where they have begun a formal fundraising campaign, but they are committed to bringing rabbinical education back to Cincinnati. And so, you know, I think this thing will continue to evolve over the next coming months, and we'll be tracking that as well.
What's would there even be demand for this rival school? Is it clear whether they'd be able to get enough students for that to be, you know, stable?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, that's part of their research now, is to do a feasibility study for this effort. But Cincinnati plays a huge role in this in rabbinical training. Dating back to its founding, you know, in 1875, it is the place for Reform Judaism, and it's known for training rabbis that have spread across the country and the southern states and the Midwest particularly, and so it has a sort of a constituency in the Jewish faith that doesn't want to see this tradition go away.
Yeah.
And so the folks in New York, which merged with the Cincinnati campus, I can't remember the date, but it's been a couple of decades now, they're trying to keep the entire enterprise alive. And that means, you know, the fate of Cincinnati is not really known.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Dan, thank you so much for your time today. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.